This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Hisham Motter, grew up in Colonel Gaddafi's Libya in the 70s. He writes, the Gaddafi regime penetrated every sphere of civic life. It implanted revolutionary committees in every institution and organization, subjugated the press, and dismantled one of the most progressive university student unions in the post-colonial Arab world, executing its leaders in public squares. Motter says families such as his, who were educated, wealthy, and internationalist, were seen as bourgeois and backward. That's why his father, a diplomat, was wanted for interrogation. The family fled the country. While living in Cairo, his father began writing against the Libyan regime and organizing other exiles to unite and overthrow Gaddafi. Then one day in 1990, a man came to speak to his father, and, as Motter writes, father went to the front door and never returned. Hisham Motter now lives in England. His debut novel, In the Country of Men, is semi-autobiographical. It was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, Britain's highest literary award. Hisham Motter, welcome to Fresh Air. I want you to read a scene from the book, but before we do, I want you to put it into context. The scene I'm going to ask you to read is a scene of a public interrogation on television. And the interrogation leads to a public execution that is televised as well. And this is the kind of thing that went on in Libya when you were living there?
Yes, it did. Not in the same exact way, meaning that this isn't a document of it, but it is definitely inspired by scenes that I saw, some even worse than this.
Just tell us a little bit what interrogations were like when they were broadcast on TV.
Well, they were rather surreal in the sense that, you know, information wasn't provided clearly, you know, the accusations, the testimonies, and so on. Suddenly, a person would appear on television sitting in a rather stale-looking, frightening room with a spotlight against them, and they are asked a series of questions, and they have to reply, and they usually look very unsettled, frightened. You know, you occasionally did see people that you knew. Libya is a very small country. You know. Then the population was only 3 million people. And so it was very common, particularly in my experience, I remember, it was rather common seeing people I knew on television. I saw my uncle, for example. I saw friends of the family, neighbors.
Getting interrogated?
Yes, yeah, appearing on television.
And what kind of questions were they asked in the interrogations?
Mainly questions to do with their loyalty to the government. See, any regime, I think, has to create, for it to regain a sense of legitimacy, to vitalize itself, as it were, it has to recreate the dark art of witch hunting. And so it comes up with new criterion against which to test the loyalty of its followers and of the pop, in this case of the public.
And what is the character in your novel accused of?
He's accused of being a traitor. He's a professor at the university, and he's accused of corrupting his students. In fact, his accusation isn't even that precise. It's sort of just being a traitor.
Is there anything you want to say to set the context for this scene before you read it?
Yes. In this scene, the neighbor, Ustad Rashid, who had been seen before interrogated on television in a different setting, in a room, is then appears onto a basketball stadium, and a committee of interrogators is there. The basketball stadium is filled to the rafters. And the family of the protagonist, Suleiman, who are watching, have an inkling that Ustad Rashid might appear, but they're not sure yet. So it starts with the stadium, the crowd, but Ustad Rashid isn't yet brought onto the stage, as it were. The crowd's chanting and cheering was so loud, so hysterical and constant, that it fused into a continuous hum, like the hum of a giant vacuum cleaner. When the people calmed down, the camera moved onto the court again. A few meters in front of the committee, another man was now present. He had his hands tied behind his back and was sitting cross-legged, on the floor in front of a microphone on a stand. He kept looking behind him at the rope. "There he is," Musa said. Then the camera zoomed in and we could see that the handcuffed man sitting on the floor of the National Basketball Stadium was Ustad Rashid. His forehead shone with sweat, his mustache too was moist, tears silvered his cheeks. He didn't cry honorably, he cried like a baby. He looked back at the rope, then at the committee who were to one side of him, and said something inaudible. "Speak into the microphone," the man in the center ordered. Ustad Rashid looked to one side and saw a man come from behind. He looked up at him, tried to say something. If I had to guess what, it would be something like, "I kiss your feet, for God's sake, for your parents' sake." Because when the man placed his hand on the microphone to adjust it, Ustad Rashid tried to kiss it. When the man walked away, Ustad Rashid looked back, searching for him. "What do you have to say in your defense?" the man at the center of the table said. Ustad Rashid looked at him and cried again. He checked the hanging rope, then turned to the man, raising his eyebrows, pursing his lips, pleading like a guilty child. "We are giving you a chance to defend yourself. If you're innocent, speak," the man said with a grin, leaning back in his chair and looking to the man and woman on either side of him, who seemed to understand his humor. "Innocent! Innocent! Innocent!" Ustad Rashid latched onto the word.
And that's Hisham Mattar reading from his new novel, The Country of Men. Did your parents try to prevent you from watching these when you were very young?
Yes, but when I was a young teenager, my father handed me a videotape of a very famous execution that had taken place in Libya, that this execution is very loosely based on, as it were. And I was 14 or 15 when I saw it. And I was deeply unsettled by it, but also deeply intrigued, because I couldn't understand it.
What was his point in giving it to you?
Well, he felt I was old enough to know, and I think he was right. I was old enough to know, and it was my right and responsibility to know what had happened in one of the dark chapters of my country.
Had he already been working for the resistance when he gave you the video?
Yes.
So he wanted to know how bad, he wanted you to know how bad the government was.
I think so, although he didn't put it in these terms. This has to be put in a caveat that my father and I disagreed very passionately at that time when I was about 14 years old over how the resistance to the government ought to be, in what sort of frame it should be placed. For me, I felt that the only resistance to anything that an individual can do is in their own behavior and their own conduct of their own life. At least then I believed that, and I think I believed it then because I was selfish and I wanted my father all to myself. It is a very harsh experience to know that your parent is devoted to a cause that is the scale of which is beyond your family. And so I wanted to adjust this, what I then perceived as an imbalance. And so we used to have these arguments, and perhaps this tape was given as one of the... But I don't remember it in that sense. I don't remember him trying to convince me of anything with this tape. I remember my brother and I very, very intrigued and wanting to see this.
Did it change you politically? Did it change your point of view about how to resist?
I don't remember that it had then, and it certainly hadn't. It hasn't changed later, but I don't remember then that it changed the way I feel. I feel that actually one of the few things that I'm proud of, and I'm not proud of many things, is that with all of what has happened to Libya and to Libyans and to my father, and countless others, I have never fantasized, even in a moment of absence, or, you know, I've never fantasized at all about watching the perpetrators suffer in this way. I've fantasized about justice, certainly, but not about revenge. And I'm very comforted by this, because I'm often rather disturbed by human beings, including myself. And so this rather comforts me, that I don't wish that on them. I don't wish them to suffer. I don't wish their children to suffer, for them to lose their property, all of the things that they have exacted on my family. I never wish them to suffer that. But I do long for justice, indeed.
Your father had been a member of the Libyan mission to the UN, and because of that, he spent time out of the country. And one of the times when he was out of the country, he got word from a friend that he was on the list of people to be interrogated and that he shouldn't come back. So then your mother had to figure out what to do. Should she stay? Should she go and try to meet him? How did your mother try to handle it?
Well, I dare not speak for my mother, but I think from my perspective, she handled it fairly well. She tried to get us out of Libya. She didn't succeed because they were, in effect, holding us hostage for him to return. And then an amnesty was issued. He returned. And then that way we were able to leave. But my father wasn't able to leave. So the situation was reversed.
This time around, you left the country and your father stayed behind.
That's right, yeah. We stayed in, we went to Kenya, and then from Kenya we went to Egypt, and eventually my father caught up with us about a year and a half later.
You know, in an essay that you wrote about your family, you tell this incredible story that when your mother was trying to get herself and her two sons, you and your brother, out of the country, you couldn't get past the immigration officials. So she tried to bribe the officials with what? With her car?
Yes, she actually succeeded in bribing the official with her brand new BMW that had also in it a brand new television and video, which in the late 70s was as good as gold. And she and the man, she sort of dangled the key in front of him and said, "Let us through." He looked at the key, took the key, nodded, and walked away. So we thought, we must wait now. He's going to come out and tell us the good news. Well, he vanished through a door that had a sign, a private sign on it, and never came out. We waited for hours. And then we learned that he had gone home. And needless to say, our car wasn't outside. So not a very successful attempt.
It was a very expensive gamble.
Yes, more expensive the other way. You know, I mean, you know, one's life is more. I mean, our life wasn't in danger, but mother really was keen on us growing outside of Libya, or at least at that time. No one thought it would be this long. We all thought that things might change. But one of the peculiar things about exile, which is one of the themes that the book is about, is that the place, there's a presumption that the place you've left is going to remain the same, and in fact you're going to remain the same. And neither are true. The place changes beyond recognition in some respects, and you alter and change and take on new experiences and identities and so on.
One of the ways in which Libya has both changed and stayed the same, Gaddafi is still the head of the country. But now, well, for a couple of decades, your father has been imprisoned there. That is, if he's still alive, and you don't really know that for sure. He was arrested after he moved to Egypt, after he got out of Libya and joined your family in Egypt. Why was he detained there?
Because of his political activity, my father was very candid about his position. He felt that a project of democratization in Libya has to take place, and that cannot happen with Gaddafi being in power. And so, you know, he engaged in that, and after 10 years of living in Egypt, he detained is not really what happened. What happened was that he was abducted and vanished, basically. We didn't know where he was. The Egyptian authorities kept telling us that he was actually in Egypt, held in Egypt by them, because he had crossed the line, as it were. They spoke in all these ambiguous terms, that he was doing too much from Egypt against Libya, that, which was by then a friendly country. And said that basically what would guarantee his release is our silence. And so, of course, we were, you know, frightened for him and kept very quiet about this. This went on for 2 years, and we would visit the officials and at the Secret Service headquarters in Cairo regularly, and be told exactly the same thing. And after 2 years, we received a letter that was smuggled from a very large and notorious political prison in Libya called Abu Slim, written by my father, signed by him, and smuggled out by someone, but then delivered it to us in Egypt. And it was really a shock. And looking back at it now, it was very naive of us to think anything else, but it's very difficult to give up hope at times. It's almost easier to pretend that things were different.
What did the letter say?
The letter described in detail his detention by the Egyptian Secret Service people, and then his subsequent handing over to the Libyans. 3 days later, he was on an airplane to Tripoli. And he described all of this in great detail. I feel such a privilege, really, because one of the most moving things is when a loved one doesn't conceal you from the truth, regardless how painful it is. And he listed these things with eloquence and such a sort of a sober attention to detail. That never stopped from being incapable of humor and reference to history and so on. I find that letter, and he sent another letter later on, and a recording, a tape, cassette tape recording of his voice. An audio letter. I find them moving not only on a personal level, but as a testament to the individual, really, to the dignity of man. He describes these details of the cell, for example, that he's in. He describes the furniture. He describes all the insects that are there in such amusing way that doesn't shy away from the gruesomeness and the pain of the experience.
Do you know if he was tortured?
I do, yes. He says it. The first 3 months of being there were rather difficult. And when my father says that, it's quite telling. So he doesn't say I was tortured, but he says the first 3 months were rather difficult. But then he was tortured in other ways, in the sense that he wasn't allowed out of the cell for months and months at a time. A speaker was placed at the center of the ceiling, playing continuously from 6 o'clock in the morning till midnight, speeches by Gaddafi and various revolutionary propaganda. I find that detail deeply telling, actually, because it suggests that the problem is that you have not listened. Not that, you know, so disagreeing with the regime is a sign of madness. And in fact, you know, the regime has several times confirmed this sentiment.
Do you know if your father's alive or dead?
I do not.
There must always be a part of you that's wondering about that.
Yes, of course. It's you know, living with inconclusiveness is very difficult. But there's an odd comfort, actually, in knowing that you can't know. At least that's one thing you can be certain of, that you've exhausted all of... Continue to try, of course, but so far I've exhausted all of the routes, really, to get information.
What are the routes?
Asking the Libyan government, asking the Egyptian government. And when I say asking, these are letters that are written every week by various Amnesty chapters, not only us as a family. For example, I know one of the chapters that held this case for you know, pretty much from the beginning, from about 93, they started sending weekly letters. This is the Dutch chapter, weekly letters to Libya. So imagine, from 93 until today, weekly letters, an average of about 30 letters a week. And not one answer. Not even an answer to acknowledge a letter. Now, this is the same for the French chapter, for the London chapter, for the Japanese chapter. Curious.
How has your father's disappearance and imprisonment affected your sense of how you want to spend your life? I mean, you've described yourself as not really being inherently political and of being more of an aesthete than somebody involved in politics. But you have to be politically engaged in some way to just kind of keep up the action, you know, in demanding an answer to the question about where is your father and is he alive?
Yes, I mean, I think the best way to bore me, actually, is political discourse. I find it deeply dull most of the time. And so I didn't seek to write a book that had to include elements of politics. It's not a political book in the sense that, to me, a political book is a book that documents a political movement or a book with a political message. This is certainly not my book. But... it is a book that cannot exclude the political happenings around the characters, the principal characters, because it was a significant part of the landscape. But with my father, it's my yearning for him and my calls for him are personal. And for me, that is very, very important, that he is not clutched away from me into these realms of that to do with politics, or in fact to be a victim, or to be a symbol of the Libyan suffering. I resist that very strongly. He to me is a man, and a man whom I knew very well and loved very deeply, and whose company I miss very sorely. And he happened to be interested in political ideas that conflicted with this dictatorship in Libya and was punished for them. And I want him rescued, not only in the physical, in the literal sense, rescued, but I want him also rescued within my own memory and my own imagination for him to never become that symbol.
Why did you want to write your novel in the country of men, from the point of view of a 9-year-old in Libya?
When I first began, all I had was a voice. It intrigued me enough to want to write it. And because the voice was of a boy living in Libya, I, of course, immediately assumed that I could put it through, as it were, some of my own memories, things I've witnessed or heard about. So, as it were, what was happening is that the life of the author was, or more precisely, the memory of the author was beginning to constrict the possibility of his imagination. This was a tremendous lesson for me, because every time I placed my unconsoled protagonist in episodes fished out from my past, he, like an uneasy guest in a fancy dress party, began to squirm and to resist these recollections. And after a year or so of this grueling and not very productive work, I realized that the moments that the book came alive, or what I was writing then, it wasn't quite a book then, but what I was writing, or episodes that came alive were the episodes that weren't trying to remember anything. They were imagined, invented episodes. And so I began to trust in the imaginative process itself. There was a very sinister, deep distrust in me before toward the imaginative process. And so I discarded that and began to trust in it. And I think this is why also I feel deeply indebted to this book in a very personal way, because it taught me this very precious lesson that not to write from memory, but from the imagination, to create, not to attempt to reconstruct. In many ways, writing is about salvaging things from the past.
Why did you distrust your imagination?
I think because I didn't quite believe that I could write. haunted, still am actually, haunted by doubt. I find writing deeply, very difficult. I find it very, very difficult. And so I just didn't think I could rely on that. So I didn't even know actually that I distrusted it. It was through the work it became clear that I did. If you had asked me then, I'd say, no, I have deep faith in the human imagination. But it only became clear as the writing, you know, that faith only really was tested through the writing.
Hisham Mater's new novel about growing up in Colonel Gaddafi's Libya is called In the Country of Men.